Welcome to Fireside Chats, Leadership Journeys, brought to you by the Office of Academic Clinical Affairs and hosted by Dr. Carolyn Porta. These chats bring together University of Minnesota Health Sciences students with experts for candid conversation on leadership, career pathways, sources of joy, and strategies to rejuvenate.
Welcome to the Office of Academic Clinical Affairs Internship Fireside Chat. Tonight, I have the pleasure of leading and having beautiful conversation with Ms. Carrie Miller and with Lieutenant Colonel Dan Jennings. I will briefly ask them to introduce themselves. I'm Carolyn Porta. I serve as an Associate Vice President here in the Office of Academic Clinical Affairs. I'm a nurse by background. The internship program has graduate students from many different health professions here at University of Minnesota. And the Fireside Chat is an opportunity for us to have conversation with professionals that have personal lives. And we don't always get to see those personal lives or talk to them about them. So we're going to do some of that tonight. Carrie, would you introduce yourself briefly and say a few things? Thank you.
I'm a journalist, and before I was at came to Minnesota Public Radio, I started in radio, and then I spent 10 to 12 years in television in the Twin Cities. I worked at Channel 5 and Channel 11, and then in 2004, I went to Minnesota Public Radio. I also host Talking Volumes, which is an on-stage literary series. In the fall, I have founded a women's adventure travel company. So, I was doing a 9 a.m. show 5 days a week, and post-pandemic kind of downshifted a little bit to a weekly book show and special projects. So the pandemic was good for my sanity and for other projects. So it's kind of where I'm at right now.
Thank you. And I'm going to circle back on this women's adventure travel.
Okay.
Before that, Dan, would you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Sure thing. Dan Jennings is my name. I lead the Salvation Army for the states of Minnesota and North Dakota. So I oversee the offices that we have. We have an office in each of the counties in both of those states. Some of them are quite large, and some counties, of course, have multiple locations, like in the Twin Cities, of course. I've been married. I've been 35 years this year. We've got two adult daughters. One lives in Chicago, and one lives in South Dakota, but right on the Minnesota border. In fact, we're as close to her as we've ever been in our professional careers. I felt a specific call to be a pastor of a local congregation, the Salvation Army has congregations, and I got to do that for the first few years of my career. But my second appointment through today, which has been now, I guess, almost 30 years, I've been on the administrative side of what we do, working in our administrative offices, overseeing the operations of statewide parts of the Salvation Army. Moved here from St. Louis, where I oversaw the work in Missouri and Southern Illinois. So this was a shock to the system to come to Minnesota from the near south, we call it. We always say the Missouri is actually a southern state that faces north, not necessarily a northern state, because everything kind of feels like the south. But before that, I did the same job in Wisconsin, Upper Michigan. So my offices were in Milwaukee, and oversaw there the state of Wisconsin and a little bit of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Just enjoy working with the Salvation Army. While the work that happens in the Army was very attractive to me early on, I wanted to be a part of that again. Have not been a practitioner of it for the last 25 years. Have been really behind the front lines, providing support and resources for those folks who actually do the work of the Salvation Army. But because I'm the leader, I can do what I want to do. So I try to get out to the front lines as much as I can, and nobody can stop me. So they do allow me to come out and just see what's happening. And that really is my primary job, is to be a support, to be an encourager, to those who are doing the work. And that has never been more important than it has been over the last 18 months or so.
Thanks for sharing that, Dan. For the interns, they're probably very familiar with the Salvation Army, but could you give them three or four bullet points of what that front line actually does?
Sure, absolutely. So the Salvation Army looks different in every community, but in the U.S. and in particular here in Minnesota, housing is probably one of the biggest things that we do, both with emergency shelters where people come in right off of the street, transitional housing and permanent housing as well. That's the biggest thing that there's a need of in Minneapolis. If you've ever tried to buy a house here or you ever looked at the market, you know that it's remarkably expensive, even for the most modest place to live. And so there is a real crisis with housing. As bad as it is, we think that it's going to be worse as we go through the moratoriums on rent and eviction coming to an end. We think that there'll be lots of people who will be in need of housing and lots of people who've never experienced homelessness who will experience it for the first time in the next year or so. Food is what we do. We do a lot of food, a lot of food pantries, and then a lot of direct service to people, and then a lot of advocacy on behalf of people who are setting goals for themselves, trying to break the poverty cycle. And so we're very happy about that. We call that Pathway of Hope, and that's been a very successful program for us to help people get out of the cycle of themselves coming, and also taking that long view that their children won't have to come to the Salvation Army for assistance.
Thank you. Each of the interns could probably describe housing and what they've heard in their programs in terms of that being a pretty critical social determinant of health. This morning, I'm pretty sure Angela Davis had housing as a theme on NPR. So if for those of you that are interested, you could go back and listen. One of her guests was talking about starting a housing cooperative, buying mobile home parts and forming a cooperative where they own it rather than being controlled by an outside private entity telling them what to do or increasing prices. So it's an interesting conversation for sure and very timely. Carrie, would you talk a little bit about your career journey and perhaps a skill you wish you would have learned earlier or developed earlier?
Skill I wish I would have learned earlier. I knew I was going to be in broadcasting from, starting out in college. I went in thinking it was going to be all about creative writing, but I was really drawn to the campus radio station. Felt like a really good fit, combination of writing and broadcast skills. I kind of accidentally ended up in TV. I enjoyed it. I covered politics and government. So, it was spending an entire day out covering events or interviewing people with a concept of a story, and then quickly writing it, the photographer would edit it, and then I would be on the air for a minute 30 at the end of the day. Not enough. I was like, I know more at this point. I was a big listener of NPR. And so it was kind of a natural next career step. I think, and maybe I knew this early on, I'm really good at managing time, managing my own, prioritizing in a day of having a lot of things kind of tugging at you. I'm really good at being able to kind of see through the noise and say, and this served me well at NPR too, to be able to say, this is the important thing, and this is how to communicate that to viewers or listeners. And here's how to build interest and enthusiasm around, here's how to activate that level of interest in the audience. It's not enough to just, send out information. You really need to engage. There's a lot of different places that people can go and take their interest. And I'd say I really understood how to do that. I really honed that skill in the last few years of TV and activated it in radio. And it served me well. I mean, for your interns who probably have a lot of different priorities and ideas and interests tugging at them, it's an important skill to be able to say, here's the core of the idea or the mission or the story or whatever it is. And how do I build on that, add context to that, and communicate that and let some of that other noise drop away? I was just talking about this with a friend who's visiting me here today, that, and she was sharing in her field that she has also learned how to do that. She's in the medical field. Mm-hmm. And it's just an invaluable skill. People that don't know how to do it, every day is kind of chaos. Every day is, how do I make sense of this? How do I choose? What do I prioritize? Where do I fit into that? So, and it's not something that everybody possesses, no matter how long you've been in your career.
Right. I'm going to agree with that. And I heard two different things there. I heard the time management personally and professionally. Mm-hmm. I also heard, and I have heard you do this on the radio, what is that important thing out of all these very interesting things? What is the important thing that you're building your message or your time in conversation around?
Right.
And I think that is very difficult for early professionals, health professionals, folks that need to go to the legislature, go to administration and request something, even just writing a thesis paper.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. It's having some clarity of the idea that engaged you initially, that kind of fired up your enthusiasm, that you felt a sense of kind of ignition around. And then in a really noisy world, to be able to let some of that go and to have confidence and clarity in what it is that you're trying to really dig into. And here's something else. I'm good at being able to bring a lot of attention and comprehension to an idea. And I think that grows ever harder in the kind of media environment that we're in. I'm sure your interns experience this too. Distraction, I mean, you can really be in control of distraction. You're not at the mercy of it. It's a super valuable skill to develop, to bring kind of full imaginative focus to an idea and let yourself really think through the idea and experience the idea without saying, yeah, but just let me check my Facebook feed or I got to take that phone call. There's less and less time carved out for that, but more and more, I think, need for that skill.
Yeah.
That makes sense?
Yeah, that's great. I'm going to remind the interns, you're welcome to put something into the chat box. You can also just pop in. How do you decide? I'm going to go to you in a minute, Dan, but Carrie, in follow-up, how do you decide that intellectual curiosity that ignited you is going to be also of interest to the world versus it's of interest to you?
Yeah, that's a good question, Carolyn. It's experience being, you know, in this business for a long time and understanding kind of what kind of lights people up. It's also having some confidence in my own curiosity. Mm-hmm. I think what intrigues me and drives me is probably, you know, something that I can pique some interest in the listeners. I mean, last Wednesday I did a show about that I called Carrots and Sticks about COVID vaccines and high engagement, because this is something that's been kind of simmering when is it time for people who are not vaccinated to lose some privileges and some access? Is it time? Is this the time? How do you feel about, you know, that kind of thing? That feels to me like a natural discussion that with all of our experience, it's time to have. And I mean, you know, Twitter was on fire and the phones were loaded. So so that just having kind of a sixth sense about what it is that people want to talk about.
Yeah, thank you. Dan, is there a skill you wish you would have picked up a little earlier?
Absolutely. I mean, trying to think how to describe it. It's not necessarily empathy, but it's more of an investigative empathy. One of the things that I do well is to be able to hone down the mission into very digestible pieces and to help the folks who report to me to do that in their area as well. But it's very easy to lose track of how the people are doing. And we have as an organization, have always encouraged self-care. And the thought was that if you resource it and you encourage it and you say it's important, people will actually do it. But what I've discovered is that people that appear to be doing okay and appear to be on point in terms of accomplishing mission can be right at a crisis moment and ready to completely fall apart. Mm-hmm. And once they get to that point, it's a resignation or it's a termination and they are gone. If I could have been more investigative early on and perhaps had more empathy about what was happening in their lives, the thought is we could bring resource and help to someone whose life is out of control. And as I think about your interns, you're going into highly stressful vocations, and it will be important for you, for those who have responsibility for you, that you communicate early because they can be helpful to you and not to wait too long. So I think the skill I wish I had is either just encouraging people to share more about what's happening in their lives, even if they feel like they're out of control, or to ask another question or two that digs down a little deeper than just I'm doing okay.
Yeah, I really like that. Does the military structure of the Salvation Army create additional barriers to doing what you've just described?
It does. And sometimes I have to realize I'm not the person to ask that question, because we're highly hierarchical. When the colonel comes and asks how you're doing, you have to say you're okay, because I make personnel decisions about what types of jobs they'll have and what their future looks like. So it's important to me to be able to come alongside one of my team who can have that conversation in a much more candid way than I'm able to have.
And yet as a leader, you can make sure your team knows it is okay to not just be present, but to also ask those questions. And I think in a lot of our healthcare settings, in any of our organizational settings, we don't always foster that, create space for that. Make it okay to be vulnerable, to be real. I know we all know Brené Brown. We all know that everyone loves her ideas and her concepts. But when we talk about day-to-day practice, I'm not convinced that many of us have gone very far in actually putting into practice, living vulnerable, living transparent, and then allowing those that report to us to also do so. Yeah. You mentioned self-care. What are your go-to self-care strategies?
So a couple of things that are just, you know, absolutely fundamental for me. One is to exercise every day. I have to do that. If I don't, I know that the rest of the day won't feel the same. I have to be outside. Even in Minnesota, where it's cold, I have to make sure I get outside and experience nature and just have that time for me to refresh. And what I've found with my schedule is that I have to create time in order for it to happen. If I have to wake up very early, which has now become a habit and it just happens naturally. But when I first made that determination that I would have to wake at 5 in order to take care of myself before I show up at the office, I had to do that. Now it's a pleasure. I feel like I'm stealing time from the day mm-hmm. by getting up early, taking that time that I could have just been sleeping. But it also has an ancillary piece, right? If you're going to get up at 5, I can't stay up till 10 o'clock. I have to go to bed early so that I can get up early. So I thought I would miss late nights, but I don't.
I am just wondering what the interns are thinking there. You just described a pretty long window of sleep.
Yeah.
Carrie, how about you? Self-care?
I mean, Dan, I'm amazed at how similar my routine is to Dan's. Exercise every day in some form. You know, making sure that I feel mentally rested. And I get that it's somewhat of like a badge of honor to power through when 5 to 6 hours a night. But I know that my brain is nimble and fluid when I've had enough rest. And so I prioritize that. I mean, I can be in an interview responsive and imaginative and take the conversation in places or whatever writing I'm doing. I can just feel, you know, my imagination firing and the fluidity and nimbleness if I've had enough rest. So I prioritize that. And as I told you, Carolyn, at the moment I'm in Tucson, and because of the ability to do remote work, there's like a little mini studio sitting here behind me. So I can do all my interviews and all my recordings here. And it's getting outside on the trail, hiking something every day, and having quiet time and not filling the day with noise and conversation and not being afraid to be introspective. And, you know, and telling people that I need the downtime, you know, the time where, and I'm not on that much social media. I mean, I do Twitter. I'm not thumbing through Instagram and, you know, Snapchat and all this stuff. I am using the time to kind of go back into introspection, which is really a great refueling tool. I'm sure your interns are like, yeah, when I'm dead, but you know, right? It's pretty valuable now. That's something I wish I had understood. You know, I've always read a lot, always. I'm a voracious reader, always have been. And that's refueling time too. But, you know, it's not really fashionable to be like, no, I'm going to sit home tonight with a really great book. But it's really valuable.
Yeah, I agree. Bethany, let me look at you. I think that leads us into one of your questions pretty naturally, and then we'll ebb and flow. Yeah.
Yeah, I was definitely just thinking that kind of aligns with one of the questions I thought about. Actually goes back to a event that I put on with one of my clubs at the vet school, talking about compassion fatigue. I had invited several different professions to be represented to come and speak with mostly veterinary students about how to face compassion fatigue. And I mean, you want to say how to prevent it, but I think that we all know that it's more of a matter of managing it than preventing. And one of the speakers was my grandpa, which I like saying, he's a chaplain with Mayo Clinic. And definitely through his perspectives was where I learned that hearing lots of different advice from different people on this topic is valuable. So as it's been mentioned, with us being health students, we're going into high stress situations. You guys have any advice for how you handle compassion fatigue or burnout in your fields?
Dan, you go first.
Okay. This is something near to my heart. And again, talking about trying to get to our people who do the front lines, who experience it and tell us they're burned out. Just this last week, visited with one of our folks who's been with us for nearly 20 years, has just reached the point where she just can't do it anymore. So she has left us, but stayed in contact, and she has taken just a menial labor job where she makes zero decisions. And for her at this time in her life, that's what she's got to do. She just can't make one more decision. She can't lead one more person. She can't hear one more story that is just tragic about what happens in humanity. And again, you know, you've got to do something to help yourself. My nephew is a palliative care pediatric doctor. And so I've just been picking his brain. How do you do that? How do you spend your days with parents of children who are dying? And he is the most happy, just always smiles. And just to say, you know, what can I do to help my people I'm responsible for adopt some of that? And is one thing is you have to be able to compartmentalize, not in an unhealthy way, but at the end of the day, those stories that just, you know, break your heart that you hear when you walk out of your office or out of the clinic, or in his case, out of the hospital, you have to leave it there. And you have to be completely present then for the rest of the people that are important to you and in your life, and just fully engage in that as you have fully engaged in your vocation before that. Not that you have to be two separate people, but you do have to be fully present in what is in front of you, and to be able to enjoy the balance of your day when you're not in those places where you're working with people that need you and need you to be there 100%, but your family, your friends, your spouse also need that same type of investment from you.
You know, this is something that I probably really tuned into for the pandemic. I mean, when it started, I was all, you know, fascinated by the science and leaning into interviewing infectious disease specialists and filling the airwaves with a lot of great science and facts. And what I found happening was when people would call in, you know, deeper into the pandemic with stories about anxiety, or they'd ask the same question I'd heard, you know, five times, I found I had a kind of impatience with that. I mean, what was happening is I was like zooming kind of ahead of where a lot of people were, and really having to kind of reckon with how are you best serving the audience? How can you best serve the audience, which is in dire need of confidence building facts and factual information and trust? And what I really had to reckon with here is trusted journalists. What's the best way to behave, you know, to really kind of have a talking to with myself to say, when people turn to you in a time of a lot of uncertainty, they don't want to hear your, yeah, we've heard that before kind of thing. And so it was kind of some self-talk and some reckoning with, even if I hear that question 10 times, I'm going to honor the spirit that it comes in with. And I was talking about this with some friends today. There are people who may call or write me and express views about, you know, what the solutions are to the pandemic that don't align with my own. And nothing is gained by being dismissive or impatient or shutting those people down. And it required a new level of patience and care that I wasn't really used to having to draw from. It was good. It was, you know, did I hit that mark every day? No. But, you know, some quiet venting behind the scenes. And then, you know, who do you want to be when you're serving listeners? And keeping that top of mind every day. And I think that's valuable for your interns because, you know, in whatever role, what face, what spirit do you present to your public, whatever they are? Pretty important to keep in mind.
I really like that, Carrie, and I also like the piece about patients. It reminds me of my own experience when I'm driving to the hospital, and as a forensic nurse, I take care of patients who have just gone through an act of sexual violence. They've just been sexually assaulted. And for me, I've done that drive. I've done that interview. I've done the exam, you know, over 1,000 times.
Right.
But for that person, it's their, it's their first and last, but it's their lived experience in that moment. And I can't be impatient ever. I have to be present. I have to connect. And so for me, as I listen to you and think about that, it is something that health professionals also have to work through, not just the compassion fatigue or the routine of a job that you do every day. You do the same specialized service every day, but every patient you see it's their first encounter with you, the professional, and they're asking the same questions over and over, right? But for them, it's the first answer. It's the first time they've heard your answer.
Carolyn, it's really valuable for me to hear you talk about this because what you'll hear from people who have been in whatever the health industrial complex, you know, whatever their experience is, yours is, the people you're seeing have been deeply traumatized. But even if you're going in for surgery for the first time, you know, I've read a lot of memoirs. Most recently, one where even asking the healthcare professional to reach out and hold your hand because you're scared to go under anesthesia and into surgery. You know, I want the health professionals to understand we need that. That is not transgressive. That's the kind of thing that we who are, you know, in this space for the first time and are frightened are looking for. So it's really fulfilling to hear you talk about that way.
Yeah, that's nice. And hopefully it's helpful to the interns as well, coming into their professional fields.
Right.
And Dan, to your point about compartmentalizing, the way I do describe some of that as well is not so much compartmentalizing, although I do agree with you, but really you have this capacity to care. And you have to have a bit of a thick skin, a tough skin, not so tough as a turtle shell, but you have to have a little bit of that. And then you've got to be able to let that go when you do leave that shift and then debrief or decompress the way you do it. And you already answered some of those questions, what each of you do, and each of the interns could answer this for themselves. Journal, exercise, get out in nature, spend some time alone, or talk to someone. Sometimes you need that. For everyone, it's a little bit different, but you have to figure out what it is for you. And you have to figure it out pretty quickly. I think it will serve you better if you can. Yeah.
No, that was amazing answers. And I just kind of wanted to add, like, the way that my grandpa's always encouraged me and how he explains it is that compartmentalizing is more like when you have, so let's say like there's somebody's mom in the ICU and that's your patient. Instead of viewing that patient as, you know, this could be my mom too. And kind of taking that on as like almost like a personal burden. He said, just remember it's your patient. Like you have to have the empathy for your patient, but not taking it on in such a personal way. He said, that's where you used to use a lot of that burnout come from. So that was very interesting how similar those answers are.
I like that. And I think too, I'm just going to go back to one thing that Carrie said. So when you've been able to experience the healthcare system or whatever that system is, as the patient, as the receiver, not as the professional, you learn very quickly, right? I mean, there have been times where I have said to the provider, this is the first time I've gone through this with my son with his broken collarbone. I know you fix collarbones every day, all day. This is my first time. And it's okay to say that as the patient, as the consumer, right? Whatever that field is.
I mean, there's a whole genre now, and I'm really grateful for this, from physicians and nurses who are writing about what they don't know when they begin and what they're learning from their patients and some of the mistakes that they're making and the influence of a patient who comes back 3 years later to say, you know what really made the difference? When you took 30 minutes and sat there with my family and heard my fear and saw my questions about whether this was terminal or not. I mean, one of the people that I look to for a lot of wisdom on this is Kate Bowler. I don't know if that name rings a bell, but Sherry, it sounds like. I mean, she is so wise. You know, she's diagnosed as a young woman in her 30s of late stage colon cancer, and yet she has lived and lived well and is writing these beautiful books about faith and the experience of thinking you're going to die and then not dying and savoring without being maudlin. And we had a long conversation about what it's like to be swept up into healthcare and have people still see you. I know this sounds like a cliche, but it is often the experience of the person that's swept into this huge, confusing, sterile, cold, environment that if you only knew my story, then you wouldn't treat me like the fifth person who needs help getting to the bathroom today, that kind of thing. Yeah. And it's really changed my thinking on this. And my willingness to say to doctors, hello, real person in that situation, should I be in it? So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Her podcast is fabulous. And I think one of the things she does is she just gives us as healthcare providers, we hear the patient perspective, right? Like you said, about what matters. And she'll describe the one or two physicians or the one or two nurses that have really mattered to her and what they did, which I find as a still practicing clinician, that's so important. And Carrie, you talked about holding someone's hand and knowing when that's right and when that's not. And so many times in my profession, and I think all of us who are practicing can speak to this, they just wanted us to sit there. And if we sat there and held their hand when they cried or cried with them, that meant something to them in a way that we can't even as caregivers, I think, imagine. And so, I appreciate her as well.
I'm so glad you're listening to her podcast, Sherry. That's great. Really good. It's valuable.
I love it. Well, we've talked a little bit about the pandemic. We are obviously in the start of year 3 here. I would love to get a little bit of perspective, maybe just reflect a bit. Have you learned something about yourself in the pandemic that you didn't know before? You've already shared some things, but there might be something else that comes to mind for either of you, Dan or Carrie.
I think, again, this comes from managing people, is that there really just isn't one right answer about how to manage the pandemic. When you have a variety of people who work for you, or even in our corporate office that we have, we've got 100 people in this office, everyone responds to it in a different way. And every decision that you make, whether it's personally or corporately, will go through the filter of each individual person. Some people will think that you've just gone way overboard and are doing too much to manage the pandemic in your office. And some people will think that you're not doing enough, that we are remarkably unsafe, and regardless of what you do, we're never going to be okay. And so what you have to do is you you listen to those and you try to understand where people are coming from and to be empathetic to what they're saying. But at the same time, you have to make the right decision for the organization as well. And things that we've learned, just a few things that are different for us. Over the last 5 years, we've discovered that the way to do a food pantry is that you let people come in and shop and look through every item and explore it and pick it out and only take the things that they want rather than having just things force-fed to you. And so we've described that as the best practice. We've adopted it at every one of our food pantries. And then the pandemic hit, and suddenly what was the best practice, now you can't do. So how do you continue to provide the type of service to people, and you continue to hear what their needs are, but you can't let them come in and shop anymore? So a lot more spending time with people and talking to people and asking questions to try to give the right care and not just, you know, rush people through or just hand them a box that may or may not be relevant to their needs. It does mean that our frontline folks have to take more time with each person to make sure that they're receiving quality assistance from our offices, but again, doing it in a way that's safe for them as well. So it's, everything that I knew about management and everything I knew about the Salvation Army over the last 30 years went out the window, and I'm learning again day by day what it is to be the Salvation Army.
So I'm hearing you say there's no right answer anymore.
No, there isn't, but you have to be, in my role again, because once I say it, it is the law. It's you have to say it in a way that gives people who want more confidence you're doing everything you can, and gives to those who think you're doing too much knowing that you have to do something. And so you can never satisfy everyone, for sure, and you can never make everyone feel completely at peace. Whatever decision you make, there'll be people who are anxious for one reason or another. But you have to give people confidence that this is for now, for where we're at and what we're doing, the right thing, and we're all going to try to do this together.
Carolyn, two things. I discovered that I have a deep capacity for science nerdness. I mean, I've always been interested in science, but I really couldn't get enough of trying to understand, infectious disease. And it was my interest in capacity probably exceeded what the show demanded. Let's just say that. And the other thing was I kind of discovered that if you have to say, this has been really frustrating. And I guess I have to concede to losing a bit of faith in human nature, but I really thought you provide people with the highest quality of information, and you have great communicators like Dr. Fauci, Dr. Osterholm. It will penetrate. And, what we've all discovered is not necessarily. That there will be a lot of denial to suit a certain political view or a personal, I'm not getting the vaccine because. And I couldn't have guessed that before we went into this. I did not think the denialism would be so hardcore and cemented as it is now, which means I didn't really understand the kind of political environment that we were living in, and I didn't understand some elements of human nature. I didn't understand, and we were talking about this today, I've got a friend who is a physician in outstate Minnesota. I would have never dreamed that, she's practiced for 30 years, that there would be a cohort of her patients that she has seen for years who would ignore and distrust her advice and tell her that they didn't trust her. I mean, these are revelations about human nature that I didn't see coming. So that's been kind of discouraging.
Yeah. Well, the nerd identity, I'm very happy to hear that because, you know, as one, that resonates.
Yeah.
And the discouraging factor, you know, it's just, I think we're all wrestling with how to not have a civil war in the next 10 years, either along political or racial or other lines. And society has shown us sides of ourselves and our society as a whole that that I don't think we had our eyes open to.
Yeah.
And we don't have the solution. So a lot of us are problem solvers. A lot of people, probably everyone on this call tonight, we want to solve a problem. We want to know what the problem is and then we can tackle it. And right now it just feels like it's not one problem. It's a really big thing. And discouraging is the right word.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, we don't end with discouragement as we're thinking about wrapping up here in the next few minutes. So let's pivot. We like that word. That's been a new word through the pandemic, right? I guess we could put in the chat box every word we now use a million times in a way that we never used to. What is the term when, for a while there, it was when, now I'm not thinking of it. It's the word when we all of a sudden built up or mounted a response, there was a phrase that people would use. Gosh, I would lose this game if anyway, I'll think of it another time. But like when we quickly scaled up a testing site, but there was a phrase people were used, stood up.
Yeah, that's right.
Clinic, we stood up of this, we stood up of that. Yeah. But once people use certain words, we just latch on.
Oh yeah. Cable news for you right there.
Yeah, it was pretty humorous. So, okay, how do you find joy these days? This is a little bit like our self-care, and it might be a similar answer, but what brings you joy, or how are you bringing joy to others that you are close to? Carrie or Dan?
Dan?
I'll start. One of the things that I've been that I really enjoyed to see is how creative people are. Whether it was finding ways to come together with family that was a safe way to do it. Some of our youngest Salvation Army officers were finding incredibly creative ways to continue to serve their community, but to do it in light of COVID. They didn't just tear down what they were doing. They found ways to stand up new ways of providing service. And it just brought me such joy and such faith in humanity that there is a large group of people that can figure out how to get things done, even in the face of a global pandemic, and to make things happen. And so that does bring me joy. And I think what's bringing me more joy now is I don't think we realized how difficult it was not to be able to interact face-to-face with people. And as we're slowly emerging out of our basements and seeing people face-to-face again, that has just warmed my heart in a new way, that coming together with people, I didn't realize what it did for me personally as a person and how it impacted my spirit. And so I found great joy in that. And then the last thing I'd say is the pandemic let me finally finish my book. So I've finished writing it. Now it goes to the publisher for some review. So I thank the Lord for a few days at home that I wouldn't have had otherwise.
Finding creative ways to see friends, even when we were in the heart, the teeth of the pandemic. I'm not a big Zoom type. So, just finding if it had to be outside on a 10 below day, just doing a short walk and then sitting somewhere where air was, that just turned out to be super important. And connecting in different ways with friends. And the other thing is, Carolyn, forming this, I formed this adventure travel company, book-centric adventure travel company on the eve of the pandemic. So the idea is, you know, go gather a group of women or women and couples and go out and to do something into nature, something adventurous, and create a reading list that really informs and influences the experience. So I actually, you know, put this all together in like January of 2020. And weirdly, it has been quite joyful planning some trips and seeing people respond with a lot of excitement and then having them ride the wave with me. I mean, I've rescheduled a trip to Bhutan 3 times. They've all stuck with me, and being able to imagine, I did a trip to the BWCA last year, and now I've got these other plans for this summer and then more trips. But seeing people kind of take it in stride and activate their imaginations and love the literary piece of it and stay true to, I know that's going to be fulfilling when we get to do it. And we're, you know, the resilience of it. But it's been an escape for me too, to just on a gray day to sit there and kind of create an itinerary and create a book list and post it and have people with a spirit of we will get there sooner or later join in and reserve the trip. I mean, it's not how I thought this was going to go, but it's how it's gone. So, you know, I've learned a lot along the way. So it's been good.
I love it. I need to learn a little more about it. I love the
Okay. Happy to send you the link.
Fabulous. Yeah. Dan, it might be fun to have you put into the chat what you think the title of your book will be. And we'll end with this question in the chat, which was also a question Bethany was going to ask. Bethany, do you want to just wrap up and ask the question?
Yeah, I loved seeing that question because we're right on the right track. Do you guys have book recommendations for us?
Maybe Dan wants to recommend his book.
Well, we'll see. Well, it has to become a book, right? That's, you know, it's not a book until, that's why they call it a manuscript. Dan and someone else will tell you if it's actually become a book. I think I've read more books than any human should. And so I don't know if I can tell you what the best book I can tell you the best book I've ever read. It may be a little indulgent to say it, but the Bible is the best book I've ever read. Being a pastor and having gone to seminary, that's, I have to give that answer. It's like it's in my contract. But a book that's been very helpful to me in the last 18 months or so is Canoeing the Mountains. It's a fantastic book about leadership. It's by Todd Bolsinger. And my favorite phrase in that book is it's a book about Lewis and Clark, and then it overlays leadership on top of that, taking lessons from their lives about leadership. And my favorite concept is that Lewis and Clark were expert orienteers, and they could follow the map precisely. And because of that, when they reached the end of everything that was mapped, those who were with them continued to trust them. And the leadership lesson is, if you want people to trust you off the map, you have to show a high skill of navigating the map. So as we went into COVID, I thought that was so important, that organizations that knew their mission, knew what they were doing, and navigated the map well, those are people that you could follow when you got off the map and no one knew the rules.
I have 4 recommendations, as you might imagine. One of them is David Blight's biography of Frederick Douglass. What's extraordinary about this is a lot of the racial cross currents and the government's response to it back in Douglass's day are still present today. I mean, there were so many echoes of what we're dealing with today. I also am a big fan of John Meacham's The Soul of America, because he writes about times when America was tested. And I think we're in another moment like that, moment in an expansive sense. And we found the resilience and the character to come through that. I just find it a very hopeful book. And when things look dark, I go back to that book. This is a book that I assigned for my Boundary Waters canoe trip last year for my company. And it's Robin Wall Kimmerer's Braiding Sweetgrass. If you haven't read it, immediately put this on your seriously. I listened to it as an audiobook. It's just extraordinary. And it talks about our ecological communion with nature. It's Dan, I think you'd love it if you haven't read it. It's just wonderful. And I'm going to put Kate Bowler on there. Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Been Told, because she's just incredibly wise and thoughtful. And I find sustenance in her thinking. You know, again, when things feel kind of tough and uncertain, I turn to Kate Bowler for some certainty there. So that's just four. If we had another hour, I'd have like another 25, but that's what I've got.
Right. And thanks, Dan, for putting yours into the chat, for sure. I really like Lab Girl. I'll just add that one.
Oh, yeah.
By Hope Jahren. So
yeah.
You know,
I interviewed her for that book. It was great.
Oh, did you? She's a Minnesotan. So for those for the interns that don't know about her, it's a little bit of a, well, it's an autobiography. She does a beautiful job and has a great story. So
yep,
that's a fun one.
Thank you for listening. Let us know what you gained from this conversation by writing a quick review. Please share this podcast with others, subscribe for future conversations, and check out our other episodes. Explore health sciences at the University of Minnesota at health.umn.edu.